When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today is a very familiar face because he's been working prominently as an actor for a while now in television, in movies. And now he is not just the star, but he is the co-executive producer of a very good new film called High Ground. I'm talking about Simon Baker. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Leonard. Hi, Jesse. How are you?
We're fine.
We're good. I wish we were in Australia, too. It's a beautiful place to be.
Yes. Fortress Australia, we call it, during the pandemic. It's kind of, it's good. It's barely touched us here because obviously the fortress walls are quite high. It's very strange.
But I'm happy that you and New Zealand get to see each other again. That's nice.
It's the bubble. The travel bubble's opened. And until there's a case that pops up and then everything gets shut down again. Very strict over here, but it has, I think, saved a lot of lives.
Yeah. Well, and Australia's a magical place, so we want it to be kept safe and sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place.
Now, you actually moved to Los Angeles for quite a while, especially while you were doing The Mentalist. And I know two of
you. I moved to Los Angeles, Leonard, actually sort of about 2 months before LA Confidential was filmed.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And then who do you work with? Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe. Yeah. So
I know. There's the bit of irony there, isn't there? That was the first job that I got in Australia, in America, was LA Confidential.
Oh, my. So you were coming to sort of put a stake in the ground and say, all right, I'm here, I'm going to do this.
Well, I wouldn't look at it like that. I would probably articulate it like I went over there with my wife and my 3-year-old daughter and just pretty much to have a crack to see what happened. And things were, you know, things, it was very, I was fortunate and things worked out really well. And America embraced me and my family. And we stayed, had a couple more kids, and I continued to work quite continuously for 20 something years. So yeah. I've been back here since 20. I made a film back here called Breath, which is a film that I directed back here in 2016. And I've been here ever since.
I mean, if you have to live in two places, they'll both do, I think.
Yeah.
We are in LA presently, and I definitely didn't. I'm married to an Englishman, and I love being there. He loves being here. And I asked him why, and he said, "You see that sunshine stuff? You get a lot of it." And I think that we're very fortunate. We both live in places that do that for us.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Can you describe for us your first day on a Hollywood movie set?
Oh, I, Yeah, I mean, I think the first day I worked on that film was a night in LA Confidential, and it's the Hush Hush magazine pot bust. And we shot it in Venice. There's a beautiful Spanish courthouse or police station or something. We shot it sort of just down the road from there. Oh no, we didn't. That was we did. We come around the side and I was handcuffed, and Jack Vincennes was sort of ushering me off. Oh no, it was fantastic. I mean, I'd worked in Australia, not on any films, but I'd worked in a lot of television and a couple a bunch of theater and stuff, some stuff here. So I was not, I was nervous, but nervous in the healthy way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm not indicating you were a novice. I was just wondering if there was anything.
I'm still a novice, Leonard. I'm still a novice. Honestly, I remember, with the television shows alone, I remember I was looking up the Malcolm Gladwell thing, that 10,000 hours idea.
Right, right.
And I figured just from The Mentalist alone, I'd done 40-something thousand hours just on that show on set. So, I mean, yeah, I'm very experienced, but still every time I go and work on something, I approach it like this is the first time. Because
that's a healthy thing to do.
Mm. That's as you said, the excitement. I feel like if you lose the excitement, then it's probably not the job for you.
That's
right. It should be something that brings you joy and makes you happy and makes you just a little bit like a healthy amount of scared.
Yeah. With that sort of, fear is a great motivator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm gonna talk to you about breath in just a little bit.
Beautiful
but
movie.
On this latest film, High Ground, which is now in theaters and on demand as well, it's a serious film, but a very compelling film as well, and it deals with things that are entirely relevant to us here in America as we re-examine what used to be called manifest destiny in our history. With Native Americans, and you are doing the same, the equivalent story in examining your re-examining your past as a country. Did someone come to you with this project, or were you seeking something of this sort?
I've always been seeking, I've always believed that cinema has this. Cinema is the most empathic art form that exists, in my opinion. So I've always been seeking this this idea of being able to reach an audience and connect an audience together through an experience, and if there is societal benefit or a social sort of development in that and growth in that, then that's even better. Movies to me as a kid, I had a tricky kind of an upbringing, and I found when I discovered the cinema, it gave me something to be able to attach my sanity to, in a way, to understand that I wasn't alone in certain circumstances and situations. I would probably categorize myself as I'm an empath. I'm an empath, very empathic sort of person. So, it could be the female lead character, but I still identify with her because good cinema, all of those barriers disappear and you just engage with the emotional core of the protagonist. I had a family very young and I always worked as an actor, sort of first and foremost as a provider, and but my heart was always, you know, the films that I watched and the filmmakers that I studied were always challenging ideas, societal ideas, and the way we view things. And I just didn't always have those opportunities whilst providing for my family to explore those. And I've had them here and there, and I take them when I can. So yes, when this film came along, I was actually, I just finished editing Breath, my film, and I was at an Indigenous festival, one of the largest Indigenous festivals in the Southern Hemisphere. It's called Garma Festival, just outside, it's a place called Nhulunbuy, not far from Yirrkala, where they speak the Yolngu Mata dialect, which is used, a large part of it is used in the film. Widiana Marika, who plays Old Man, the grandfather character in the film with the great hair in high ground and the great beard. Widiana is from that particular area, Yirrkala. And I ran into the director whom shot music videos in the 90s when I was first starting my career in the early 90s. He was the cinematographer on them. And he lived in the Northern Territory and sort of grew up there. His father was a teacher at the local school. And I just happened to be at this festival, and he has a shock of curly hair, red curly hair. And I saw him from behind, and I hadn't seen him in maybe 30 years. And I just said, "Jono?" And he turned around, and it was him, and we just connected. And he had been trying to get this film made for 20 years.
Oh, my God.
In various forms, just in the process. And Jack Thompson, the wonderful Australian legendary actor, Jack Thompson, who'd been a friend of mine for a long time, was involved in the film as well. And next thing you know, I sat down and he said, "Look, you know, we're trying to get this thing going." And I got involved.
Well, Jack Thompson would be the seal of approval on any project involving Australia. I'm such a fan of his and have always been. It was wonderful to see. It's a good part for him too.
He's fantastic. And this movie was in his heart. I mean, Jack has done a lot. He has a lot. He is definitely over his career, over his life, has contributed an enormous amount to Indigenous rights and issues. So it was very close to his heart. He has the Jack Thompson Foundation, which is an organisation that works throughout the Northern Territory about housing and building housing.
I would say to our audience, if you are not familiar, both Australia and New Zealand have this incredible history with Aboriginal people, Maori, and there's so much to learn about that. Some of it is wonderful, some of it is terrible. But it is really important to learn about and understand why people are talking about it more and more and more and trying to make sure that it's something that people are more familiar with.
And as far as Jack Thompson goes, he was sort of the torchbearer, if you will, for new Australian cinema, which I'm old enough to remember when that happened, living in New York City at the time. There was this wonderful kind of discovery. Oh my gosh, there's another source of good movie making, and it's down under. And as the star of Breaker Morant, he helped lead the way.
Breaker Morant, you know, his role in Wake and Fright as a very young actor. Jack was. For a long time, he was the poster boy for Australian cinema, and I think that's really interesting, considering that I think that's how a lot of the world viewed Australia, was people that looked like Jack Thompson and myself, and on our shores exists this incredibly ancient, rich culture. The oldest existing culture in the world at this point has been dated to 60,000 years old. This culture that still exists in this country. And we We learned very little about that in school. I learned nothing about, you know, Australian history starts from Captain Cook arriving.
Mm-hmm. Right.
1770.
And again, we have the equivalent situation here in the States.
Yes, very similar.
We learned less than nothing about our Native Americans, and we mistreated them terribly and marginalized them, to put it mildly. Some people are, you know, trying to make up for a lot of lost time now.
Yeah, and I think that's what this film does very successfully, is that, you know, and I've sat with audiences, I've sat with community audiences in the Northern Territory, in Indigenous communities, and people that were involved in the film, their ancestors were massacred in these massacres that existed through through the period of the frontier wars. And you see how affecting and how powerful and empowering it is for those communities to see their story told, to see that truth told. Mm-hmm. And then I've also sat with audiences in sort of, you know, more, you know, in different cities, in more metropolitan areas, and had conversations with white Australians that have seen the film that have been completely confronted by the film in a way where it's so uncomfortable and so difficult for them to sit through certain aspects of it. But at the same time, all of them feel compelled to say that I think every Australian should see this film, because it's one thing to talk about the atrocities that took place and to know about them, but to actually, you know, in the terms that we use these days, to hold space for it, to actually sit and sit in that uncomfortable place and feel uncomfortable about it is another thing. And that's when empathy opens. That's when you open up. And I think this film has that potential. And like you say, most indigenous cultures around the world at different times have had struggles with colonization. You know, and colonizers did everything they could to pretty much wipe out indigenous cultures, because they thought that their way of living was the ultimate way. You know, and now like you know one thing that's I'm quite involved with a lot of climate action, a few different climate action movements, but You know, Australian Aboriginals existed sustainably on this land in Australia, harmoniously with and Widiana talks about it in the scene, in the big meeting scene, with, you know, Mother Earth and Father Sky, and the perfect balance of that for, you know, time immemorial, right? Mm-hmm. For 60,000 years, they existed peacefully and sustained way of living, where there's a great respect for what the earth provides to them. And there's so much that we can learn from indigenous cultures around the world that we just I don't know, I guess maybe we're just too arrogant you know, to think that maybe we might have got it a little bit wrong here.
Yeah.
Well, if it helps at all, my dad doesn't throw anything away ever. So he's very eco-conscious. I believe this sofa is from 1975?
Yep.
Yeah. So
it is exactly that.
We're very aware and we do our part.
I hasten to add, though, Simon, that watching this film is not like taking medicine. You know, my wife and I really got involved and found it very, very moving and very suspenseful, and it's a good piece of drama, as you know, as well as a history lesson.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is there's always the challenge where you're melding art and commerce in a way, and you also want to make something that's a story that's actually entertaining.
Right.
You know, the majority of the Indigenous actors had never acted before, so. You know, Jacob Junior Nyingol, who is, you know, it's his story. The film is his story. 2 days before he started shooting, he was a ranger. You know, he'd never acted.
Huh.
Yeah, I met with him. We sat down and read through a couple of lines, and I sort of said to the director, "I think he can do it." He, you know, he's got a beautiful presence and a beautiful soul, and you know, culturally, he's got story in him. It just exists in him.
Well, he could, and he did.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I am a compulsive credit reader. I'm the last one out of the theater, out of a screening.
It's very lonely.
But I noticed a credit on this film I've never seen before. Croc Spotter.
Yeah. 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 I mean, we were on country. We were in the places where these things sort of went on. I mean, we were in some incredible locations just to drive to work breathtaking. Yeah. But, well, there's places there that actual white fellas have never been to before, you know, and all of these locations that we went to, we had traditional ceremony to welcome us, to bring us in. So we had smoking ceremonies and we were sung into these places so that it was all okay, and that we could relax, and that the land knew that we were there to do a good thing. And so there was this beautiful, that was really moving and powerful. And then we'd be sung out of the location as well when you'd leave a particular location. And these places were incredibly remote. On the way to work, where the settlement was built, we built that settlement, and during the wet season, that whole area is under 10 feet of water. And when it's the wet season, because it's so close to the coast, as a crow flies, it's only like about 5 kilometers from the coast. But you've got crocodiles and water buffalo, two major issues. And the crocodiles, they don't stray too far from the waterhole, but we had a croc wrangler on the set that had a big, long hardwood stick, and because they just give them a whack on the head and they don't like it. And we had one, a big female croc, that would come up and walk through one of the sets a lot. So he was always there. But during the wet season, when it floods, you've got all through that area, you've got crocodiles, saltwater crocs, you've got massive stingrays, you've got bull sharks as well, you know, because of that, they like the brackish water, the half salty, half fresh. So all that area is covered with that, and basically certain different communities become islands, so everyone has to get around via boat. In that particular area, but we were backed up right against the wet season, so there was tremendous rain, thunder, lightning, storms most afternoons when we were shooting, and then you come back the next day and it would be beautiful again. But yes, every day driving to work, we'd drive across Cales Crossing, which is a causeway, and the water would be sort of 2 feet high up the side of the car, and there'd be crocodiles on either side catching barramundi as the barramundi would come across the causeway. Yeah, very
PAs. Those poor PAs, they're coming in, they think they just have to empty trash, they gotta get you a soda, maybe some coffee, and instead it's like,
nah, it was not that kind of shoot at all. It was very kind of everyone together, and you know, and There's a lot of cultural stuff that you have to that has to be addressed when you're shooting up there as well, with extras where you have different types of relationships between relatives. So there's two sort of, in that particular area, there's two sort of moieties. So you're one or the other, and it's an indigenous cultural kind of roadmap to avoid incestuous relationships. It's been very traditional. So you have what they call wrong-skinned relationships, right? Mm. So just to avoid that. So you have avoidant relationships with certain family members, so that there's never a chance. But you can't sit those two people next to each other.
Oh my!
So transporting extras to the set, it was like you couldn't. You know, people would sit at lunch. So you're dealing with all of these things, which is really fantastic and really kind of, it's bigger than you as a film.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
I think a lot of films need to know that there's actually stuff bigger than them existing in the world.
Well,
that you can't just buy that situation out.
Geez.
No. Well, it certainly gives you perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
Got great perspective.
Yeah. You are sitting right behind you, on the wall behind you is a foreign language.
A great poster.
One sheet for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
With Jack Nicholson pictured boldly there. And we just had the Turner Classic Movies Classic Film Festival this past weekend and watched a terrific interview with Michael Douglas, who produced that movie and who sort of earned his producer stripes on that movie, and which of course won 5 Academy Awards. Are you finding that you enjoy producing? Aside from directing and writing Breath, you also were a producer on it, as you were an executive producer on this film, High Ground. Do you like having some measure of control?
Yeah, I do. Some measure of control is an interesting way to put it. I think that the nuts and bolts of producing, you know, this a film producer is it's a pretty broad term.
Oh yeah.
And it gets broader and broader depending on what production you're on. But I do like having a stake in what's going on from that side. Mm-hmm. Because things can, you know, it's very hard to get a film made these days, and particularly the type of films that I'm interested in making. They're not just writing checks and blank checks and handing them out. So, you know, they're films that may be a little bit more challenging or more, sort of probably more fit more into that kind of era of filmmaking. But so it's nice to know what's going on with that stuff. You know, with this film, there was a lot of challenges involved in this film, and Stephen Johnson, who directed the film, was also one of the producers. His hands were very full. It was a lot for him to take on, and there were certain aspects where you know, to keep the production going, he needed some help here and there with some certain things. And both Jack and I were executive producers on it, and we helped in what ways that we could with our experience to keep the thing going and keep it on track to get it made. Because once we were there, once we kind of had the amount of money that we had, you could just see the opportunity. It's like it's not often that you find yourself in the circumstances that we found ourselves in, where it's like, I will never see this again. I will never see a situation where we have the whole local community and we've recreated this period, and everyone is in playing roles that their great grandparents played, or that, you know, that's just probably never going to happen again. So let's do what we can to contribute to making it a good film, instead of just standing back and do this part. So yeah, I like collaboration. I like being invested and involved, and putting my heart into it as much as I can. And with that, when my heart's invested, then my experience comes with it.
Yeah.
Which is can be a good thing, as long as it's well managed.
Well, even, I mean, what you're saying about having young people come in who are not actors, you mm-hmm. get a sense of whether or not they can do it, because especially having done the TV shows you've done, you know, I think that you meet so many people. The number of guest stars on TV shows, especially long-running ones like you've had, you know, you meet, I can't even begin to imagine how many human beings.
Oh, I mean, just the, you know, I did a show called The Guardian, and I, you know, it's like, I think I worked with Chris Pine on his first job, Chloe Moritz, you know, she was like 4 years old, and I improvised with her, you know, and she's this little kid. It's like Zac Efron, you know, all of these different people that go on and have these careers you meet in that area. And I'd also come off Breath, where I had the two leads were non-actors.
Right.
So I like that. I like working with non-actors. And I've been engaged in the process of filmmaking or making TV, that process, so much of my life that I, you know, I don't, I believe in the process. I believe that if you're patient and you set up the right set of circumstances and the framework and infrastructure around it, you can make that magic. It can happen.
Well, you also get incredible training on shows. You know, if you're from America, then you've done some, whether it was ER or Law and Order, any of those kinds of things. When you're an Aussie, it's Neighbors and Home and Away. You know, the training you get, being given stacks of lines maybe a day before, if all goes well.
Day out, you're on the set and you're figuring it, you're troubleshooting the whole time. It's incredible training. If you have that in mind, if you're mindful of that. I mean, I worked with a lot of actors that were really just not interested. It's just, I'll come in and do my bit in this. But I've always been curious. I've always loved photography. If I didn't work for me as an actor, I was very interested in studying to become a cinematographer. I like all aspects of filmmaking. I like all the different mediums. I love production design. I love sound design. Mm-hmm. Sound design, it's like the unsung heroes, in my opinion, of cinema.
We're speaking to Ben Burtt this week.
I mean, it's the difference between a movie and a bit of video footage, really, these days, isn't it?
Yeah. It's night and day. It's an incredible thing.
Now, you have been a surfer most of your life, yes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you always know, or was it sort of destined for you to make a film about surfing?
From a really young age, when I was... I lived in a little small town, it's not so small anymore, on the north coast of New South Wales, a place called Lennox Head, and it was such a small little community, and we were, you know, we rolled around together in the ocean and in nature and challenging each other, and, you know, it's all very sort of Stand By Me-ish stuff. But at that age, at about 15, I knew there was something special about our childhood, even while it was happening. I was like, this is kind of incredible, the freedoms that we're afforded and what we're doing and how we're able to sort of push up against nature in a way to challenge and explore who we are and develop. And I thought, someone should make a movie about this one day, about this sort of upbringing. And that was when I was about 14 or 15, was when I was really just getting into watching films. And then, so when Breath did come along, Mark Johnson, the producer Mark Johnson, gave me, had read the book and sent the book to me and said he thought of me, you know, we'd worked together on a show on The Guardian, actually, and he sent the book to me and said, I thought of you when I read this book, and I was wondering if you'd be interested in producing it with me. And then that's what sort of where it started. And it was kind of a bit of a live stream to make a film and to make a film about coming of age. Yeah.
So now I've asked this question many times, and because it always fascinates and puzzles me, how do you direct yourself? Charlie Chaplin did it, Orson Welles did it. It's been done many, many times. Clint Eastwood, and the list goes on. But who do you lean on when you're shooting a scene and you have to do your acting job, lose yourself in the scene, but still be keenly aware of what's going on as the director would?
Well, the devil's in the details. And I think as the director, you really have to be really across the details. Like I'm very diligent about every little thing that's going on, all of it. And I'm sort of hyper-vigilant with that stuff. Generally on set, you don't really kind of anoint someone with like, okay, so while I'm on there, this is the person. But film sets are very organic places, I find. And it just, sometimes it just surfaces that this person, I realize that this person gets what I'm doing in the bigger picture, and that they're honest and reliable. And, you know, different times when I've, you know, I directed episodes of TV shows that I was obviously the lead in as well. Sometimes it's really easy and efficient because you kind of, you know, you don't have to have those conversations with actors, and you don't have to deal, you know, manage how they're going to take a certain note or whatever, because everyone has a different sort of personality and a different way of taking in information. So it's very easy in that way. Like I know myself. And at the same time, I think a benefit too is I know my limitations, you know, and I think you could probably say that. I think you could probably say that about Clint Eastwood. I think Clint kind of really knows his limitations, and he sits really squarely within that and really comfortably. That doesn't mean he's not capable of incredibly great performances, but he sort of, I think as an actor, Clint, before he even directed, he sort of knew his limitations as an actor, and he sat really well in there, and he owned it. I'm as an actor that directs himself, I'm not blessed with an enormous amount of range as an actor, so it's a little bit easier for me, I think.
I will disagree with that, but whatever you like to say, sure.
Nine tenths of it is convincing yourself that it's going to be okay, really.
Absolutely. Well, so what is it like, you know, because you have done so much of everything, you know, at this point, what is your favorite thing about doing a TV show? What is your least favorite part? What do you prefer, you know, doing movies? It's such a, you know, some people will always go back to the stage. That is their happy place. Mm. That is where they're fulfilled. Some people, it's being behind the camera. You know, that just makes them happy. What for you?
I don't know.
That's
okay. I don't know. I mean, that's part of like the search, really, is trying to find that. I really like the community and the familiarity of working on a TV show. And the fact that there's something creatively in the challenge of trying to keep things fresh and alive when you're doing it, you know, for the 7,000th time.
Yeah.
Where you're basically, you know, you're doing a scene that you've literally done 25 times. It's just that this time it's a different bunch of guest actors, and you look over at the writers and you're like, wow, okay,
really, guys.
Here we go. And then, you know, I understand that they're writing that same scene and they're just as confounded as I am, but I've taken it on as my responsibility to try to make that fresh and try to inject something into it. And I love that about television. What's exciting about film is that it's finite. Like you've got these 5 weeks or these 3 weeks or whatever it is, you've got this much money and you've got this much time and go,
yeah.
You know, and there's something about that is exciting and challenging. And, you know, maybe no one's going to do it again, or you're not going to do it again, and you won't play that character again. And that's, That's thrilling. And you can also, with a film, it's almost like you can create the culture of what that film is. Like for me as a director, I look at like the first 5 minutes of a film is you're teaching the audience how to watch you. How, right. You know, how do you watch this film? And you create the language of what that film is, and you can create all these sort of different types of sort of nuanced cinematic language styles, and you've got to live within that framework. And I love that. That's exciting. Like if you know the films that I love a lot, I like Mike Nichols films. I like mm-hmm. I like Scorsese films. I like Hitchcock films. I like Truffaut films. I like those classic films. But even those filmmakers, like if you look at Scorsese, he has his particular penchant for certain things, mm-hmm. but he always creates the culture of what that film is. And how you're going to watch it, how you're going to engage with it. You know, is it going to be something that comes at you, or is it going to be something that pulls you toward it? All of that dance is exciting and fun. And you kind of lose that with a television show. You kind of got to get that in the first couple of episodes, and then you're away and people are tuning in for the familiarity. You know, they're like, didn't disappoint. It's the same. And, you know, if there's an episode that's a little different, they go, well, that didn't feel like an episode of Succession. It felt like something else. Like they want the familiar. Whereas with a film, you can from the opening scene, you can go, what the hell is this? Mm. What world am I in, and what rabbit hole am I going to go down here? I had no idea.
Well, both of those things have proven to be lifelines for millions of people during the past year.
Yeah.
Mm. As we've all been stuck at home. And there, just as you're saying, some nights my wife and I will want the equivalent of comfort food, and we'll seek out a TV show that we are familiar with because it's going to, you know, help us just get
through. There's Groucho. Everything's okay.
Yeah. You know? And then other nights we feel a little more adventurous and we'll try something we haven't seen before. And goodness knows all these new series coming on the streaming networks and such. So the variety is an asset in that case.
Yeah.
When I'm a great fan of touting films that I think didn't get the audience they deserved the first time around.
Yeah.
Mm. And one of my favorites of yours is Something New. I think that's the terrific romantic comedy, an irrelevant comedy. You know, it's a film that, again, doesn't beat you over the head,
but
it has something valuable to say.
And I love to tell people about Ride with the Devil.
That's an interesting film.
I really like that movie. And it's Ang Lee. What was it like working with Ang Lee?
Oh, fantastic. I mean, I think, you know, there's very few directors that I worked with that I, you know, that I really felt encouraged by, in the sense of, you know, like Ang, even back then, he, you know, a couple of rehearsals with Ang, or, you know, would be a sit down talk, and he'd talk through the character and the story a little bit individually in a room. And I remember just then Ang, when we did that before we started shooting, and Ang said, do you write? Do you want to make films? And I went, yeah, I do. But, you know, at this point, eventually I will. And he was sort of very encouraging about that. And just being able to watch him, he's so sort of transparent in the way he makes a film. Like he's very simple. I remember Fred Elms was a cinematographer on that film, and we were blocking a scene once, and Ang said said to Fred, I want to tell this story with these two characters, between these two, and this story here, these two. Right. Meanwhile, the scene's about something completely different, but this is the story. And so to me, I was like, okay. And he said to me one point, I was doing a scene in the cave, in the sort of cave thing, not cave, like a little hollow that we were living in during the winter. And he said to me, don't do the face change, which was his way of expressing like an emotional shift. Don't do the face change on the line while you're talking. He said, because when you're talking, we're listening. And when we're not, when you're not talking, we're watching. And to me, I just got goosebumps. To me, I was like that was a revelation. That was like the best acting lesson I've ever had in my life, and the best directing lesson I've ever had in my life. And I was like, right there in the simpleness of that. When you're talking, we're listening. When you're not talking, we're watching. And I mean, it's basic, it's simple. I don't know why, but I always think about, what's that Rolling Stones documentary? Altamont documentary, what was it called?
Gimme Shelter.
Gimme Shelter. Gimme Shelter. And there's a moment in that documentary when the band is sitting around, I think it's down at Muscle Shoals, and they're listening to in the studio, Wild Horses being played back. I don't know if you remember the moment. And the camera's on a long lens and it's sitting on Charlie Watts, and he's just sitting there and he's a million miles away. You know, Mick's got his feet up and he's kind of doing all this and Keith, obviously. And Mick's kind of sitting there like listening to the vocals. But Charlie Watts is staring straight down the barrel and he's completely oblivious. He's completely unaware. And it's a long lens shot and it holds for so long and he's not aware. And then you see him become aware of the camera and you see this shift in him. And I was like, that's the best acting lesson I've ever seen. I was like, that's it. If you could just do that.
Right.
Yeah.
You can see those thoughts and those awareness, you know. And obviously there's certain people that, like Anthony Hopkins in The Father. I watched that film the other day. Oh, my.
Oi.
What?
Oh, man. It's like, someone said it's like a master class watching him do that role.
It's a master class, but it's also just this other thing that is not like, forget about it even as a class. Like, you can't learn that.
Right.
That guy just allows it. You know, it's almost like he just allows the thoughts and ideas to flow so honestly and so naturally in and out of him. It's beautiful. I mean, he's always been incredibly gifted at that particular style of acting like Remains of the Day, where thoughts and ideas just wash across him and flow through him. But this is like so amplified in that way. It's what an amazing bit of filmmaking that is.
Yeah.
That was
that close up at the end. Oh.
So I'm my dad's editor. When he writes reviews, I read through everything. And that was one where I read through his review and I said, did you like it or did you not like it? He says, what do you mean? I said, I can't tell if you liked it or not. And he said, it hurts so much to watch. And that was the thing, is that it's the kind of movie where he couldn't say, yeah, go watch it. You'll have a blast. It'll be great. At the same time, this is incredibly, it's beautiful and it's moving, but it's difficult. And that was really interesting to me and my mom had the exact same response. She went, I mean, it was fantastic, but now I'm really depressed and I want to go eat ice cream. I said, I get it, Mama. I get it.
Mm. I know what you mean, Leonard, is that thing. It's like, did you like it or not? It's like, often people say, well, is it good? It's like, you just should see it. That's what I say. You should see it because you're going to have your experience with it. And I think High Ground is that kind of film as well, where it's like, you're going to have your experience of it. And I love that. I just love that.
Well, it's personal. You know, it's a personal thing.
You talked about movies being an empathic medium, which they certainly are, but they're also so personal. I mean, it's like reading a book. You have a relationship with a book that's entirely interior. And when you watch a movie, you are locked into that movie. If it's a good movie, it gets to you in such a way that you can't compare your reaction to the person sitting right next to you. If they didn't grow up the same time and place you did, if they haven't experienced life as you have, I tell this to my students all the time, that how can we all have just sat and watched the same movie in the same auditorium, on the same screen, and yet you liked it and you didn't. Well, yeah. Because you two people are different.
Yeah.
All right, I'm sorry, I don't
know. And that's okay.
And that's okay, exactly.
That's the big one. And from my dad as a critic, he's constantly saying to people, you don't have to agree with me. That's okay. You're not wrong. I'm not wrong. That's okay.
All right, Simon, I don't know the answer to this, and I should. Where is your star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame?
Yeah.
Well, it's outside a restaurant. I don't know the name of that restaurant.
it's on
Hollywood Boulevard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's outside a restaurant there. That restaurant's probably changed hands four times.
Yep.
It's probably just empty now since the pandemic, unfortunately. Right. But it's not far. I think it's sort of across the road. It's like not far from the Kodak Theater.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Sure.
Across the road there. Yeah.
Maybe it's right in front of Ripley's Believe It or Not.
No, it's not. I wish it was.
We'll pay more attention next time we're walking on that block.
Congratulations, because that is just incredibly cool.
And thank you guys for your support of this film.
Well, it's our pleasure. We always want to tell people when we see something worthwhile. And you certainly gave us something worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. And Breath as well. Where is Breath available? Can people download, watch, streamy, all those things?
Oh, yeah, that's on all the platforms, yeah.
Great, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, guys. Cheers. And, what a lovely father and daughter duo you are.
We fooled it's another really, one.
It's really good.
It's
good. Hey, we're all fooling people.
Right?
Hey, thank you, guys. Take care.
Thank you. Take care.
Be well. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye. Folks, I know we didn't get to talk about Devil Wears Prada. I know. There are about a million interviews about that one. It is absolutely one of my favorite movies, and I do think it ages like a fine wine. It is still a really good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I still wish that I could get that grilled cheese that they make in the film. Anyway, we're very grateful to Simon Baker, speaking to him all the way in Australia, and he's doing press for this film. We're grateful that they made time for us.
And you can make time for us.
Ooh, nice.
If you want to find us on the social media platforms.
All of the platforms. You are at Leonard Maltin and I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You're also on Facebook. You can also go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And of course, we are on Patreon.
Maltreon.
It's still called Patreon, you know.
I mean, I call it Maltreon.
Well, and that's fine. But
I call it.
And you're entitled.
Thank you.
You're entitled.
Thank you, sir.
If you go to patreon.com/Maltin on Movies, you can find different ways to help support what we do. And we appreciate everybody who does that. And that's what enables me to say, we'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.